Thanks.
Thank you so much. So I really want to ask you about this record that you put out in August. It's called Murmuration Nation. So for those who haven't heard it, you know, this format that you're in here today with us is one that I think is very recognizable to Indigo Girls fans, a voice and a guitar, or maybe normally two voices, but voice and guitar.
Yeah.
But when, as soon as you put on this record, you immediately realize from the first moment of it, this is not an Indigo Girls record.
Right.
It's a big sound. There are jazz sounds and R&B and rock guitars. There's some electronics on it. It's a real kind of big sound. And so, you know, naturally I'm curious, had this album been in your head for all of these years, or was there a moment where you sort of put it all together and thought, now is the time, I've got to do it now?
Well, I mean, the work that I've done with Amy over all the years has been so satisfying to me, but there came a time when I just started to have a little bit of an itch to do something that was more groove-oriented.
Yeah.
Because by and large, Indigo Girls don't do, like, groove-centered music. And I am so influenced and inspired by African-American, either gospel, rap, you know, soul, R&B, all that kind of stuff. So I just felt I wanted to make a record that had that influence at its core, but also would typically have, you know, like thoughtful lyrics, and that would be quite produced and not as much of, there's very little acoustic guitar on the album at all, and only pieces of electric guitar. So in fact, when I went to practice to learn for the tour, I had to practice parts, like sporadic parts, rather than playing
just
through the whole song.
The
So it was quite an adjustment. And at first it just didn't even feel like a song, but they are songs. And with this album, all the parts that went together to fit, to lock intricately together, are not glued by a strumming acoustic guitar.
Right. And so is this something that, you know, I mean, in 1996, did you want to make this record, but for reasons that you couldn't control, you weren't able to? Or was there something about this moment that really called to you?
I think it's in the way that Amy made punk records and like old school country record was stuff that we don't do easily together. And I don't think that, you know, this kind of groove music is Amy's natural inclination to go to. And so there are hints at it. Like I did a song with Amy called Digging for Your Dream, where we actually used a loop that played. And then I have an old song called Soon Be to Nothing that had an 808 machine that played through it. So, I'm always like itching. I've always loved drums, playing live with a band. I just love a strong rhythm center. So, you know, it's just something that was slightly different from what we were doing. And so that's why I wanted to finally make the record.
And you feel like, you know, being in the Indigo Girls and that not being kind of a core sonic quality of the group, was just something that sort of like was growing and growing. Like, you know, you love drums, you love rhythm, you love groove. You know, were you kind of seeding, you know, Indigo Girls songs or your ideas for stuff that was coming out in all through those years as much as you could, or totally kind of pushing it aside and sticking with the formula?
I think there were probably elements in songs, like even on our most current album, One Lost Day, there's a song that had an arpeggiator in it, like a keyboard part. And I Wish You Hadn't Learned It on Me is the name of the song. And when that arpeggio part kicked in, listening to it, I was like, I love that so much, you know. So I could tell that I was bursting to get that kind of sound out. And I think if I'd gone like hardcore on trying to produce an Indigo Girls song in that sort of way with arpeggios and beats and stuff like that, it probably might have felt just a little bit like a fish out of water for us. But but for me, it had grown large enough that I wanted to try that. And then Lyris Hung, who produced it, she's played violin with me and Amy. She's classically trained, but she's also had a metal band, and she has just a broad, vast grasp at music and using pedals and different sounds. And so she was instrumental, no pun intended, actually, in creating the vision, the sonic vision for the album.
Were you nervous in any way? I mean, you obviously put yourself in her hands to some great degree,
Yeah. Yeah.
Was that something that took a little bit of like a leap of faith on your part?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big time. We had a lot of conversations about it. One was that, you know, she would take out a guitar part and I'd be like, well, all right, we'll try that. I mean, I wrote the guitar part, but, and then that was fine. And then other discussions we had was that she wanted everything to be played by humans on the record, but the demos were all based on beats, electronic machine beats. which I loved. You know, I grew really attached to the demos, which is a common, you know, slippery slope. Don't get attached to the demos or else you release them as your album. And they're not as good typically as the finished product. Typically, I say there are exceptions, but she wanted everybody to play. And so I had that was a leap of faith for me to accept that. In the end, there were a couple things, a couple beats I insisted on keeping in there. And then the other big discussion was, when we take the album out, can we replicate everything on the album? I wanted to replicate a lot of what went into the recording. And she felt that even if we couldn't get that sound of the Armenian wind instrument, the duduk, that she would cover it on violin and just play it her own way. And I had to adjust to that because... Yeah. I loved those sounds and those things, and I wanted to hear them. And she's like, it's going to be okay. And it has been, of course.
And some of that release, is that in some way rewarding in its own right to kind of, you know, let go a little bit of what you hold to be your ironclad ideas?
You know, that's a very good question. It's coming to mind, like, as a kid who doesn't think that they like cotton candy. You know, they'd rather have a carrot, say. And the mom, who's the boss, says, I want you to try this cotton candy. You're really going to like it. And then, of course, the kid loves it so much. And it's like, you're right. Kind of that feeling. Like the childish place in me that fought certain suggestions. So there was growing, but I'd call it growing pains. Yeah. But now, of course, I really love this album. I'm proud of it. And it's the album that I wanted to make. So in the end, all those lumps that I sort of took as I grew as a musician and as, you know, as a listener, paid off.
Yeah, cool. So let's go back to the music. Tell me a little bit about the next song you're going to do for us today.
Well, the next song is hopefully going to be in tune. So I'm going to have our listeners enjoy this nice tuning.
I think our listeners will listen to whatever you play them. So this is the second song, and then we'll move on to the third one.
Yeah, this one, this song is actually going to be an open E tuning, and I was inspired by, let me just turn this tuner on, by Tedeschi Trucks Band, by Derek Trucks, who I understand plays everything in open E, and I was listening to his stuff like Midnight in Harlem and other songs like just over and over again. And so I said, well, I want to write something in open E. And I ended up writing this song.
Have you and Amy been, you know, multiple tuning kind of players? Or have you been sort of conventional tuning this whole time?
We've done both. I think I use more multiple tunings than Amy does. You know, I listened to a lot of Joni Mitchell growing up. And then David Wilcox actually introduced me to a tuning that I started using a lot. Like I wrote a song, Love Will Come to You, on it. And then Mary Chapin Carpenter taught me a tuning that I wrote about 10 songs on, including Galileo. So, and the reason why we use tunings, like Amy might be in standard tuning and I'm in a funky tuning, close enough for jazz, right? Is that then you get, like, you're not hearing the same guitar part coming through. So if I'm up high or in a different tuning, just texturally and musically, it's more interesting.
Yeah.
So we always tried to sort of make the most of the two bits that we had, you know, two guitars, two voices, which also explains why we did a lot of descant parts vocally and just sort of filling out the arrangements.
Yeah.
So this song is called Sad One. It didn't have a name for the longest time, but... The tuning is from
the demo title. So there are things.
Yeah,
the
demo title was
right?
Sad One. And yeah. And then and Lyris, this was another point of contention we had, a friendly point of contention. And she wanted to call it Sad One. I was like, we can't call it Sad One. You can't just call a song Sad One. She's like, yeah, I like Sad One. I was like, all right. So here it is. Sad One. It's sad too.